Welcome to Groundwire Community Radio News, brought to you by volunteers at Canada's community radio stations.
This is our 2016 Year in Review episode.
This episode of Groundwire was produced on the traditional territory of the Mississaugas of the New Credit by the Groundwire National Coordination Team in Toronto.
We are your hosts,
Noreen Rahmdullah
and David Knapp, and this is the 2016 Groundwire Year in Review episode, where we highlight some of the most significant news stories covered by Groundwire this past year.
From coast to coast, Leelu Island to Muskrat Falls, this past year marked by Indigenous resistance to pipelines, condo developments, and dam construction. Here are some highlights from this past year's coverage by Groundwire.
In January, Gunargi O'Sullivan of CFRO spoke with Big Fire Woman about Leelu Island. A resistance camp was established by hereditary chiefs on Leelu Island to protect the water and salmon in August of 2015. The camp continues to this day despite pressure from the Prince Rupert Port Authority to shut it down.
The people of your territory voted 100% against the project, yet they continue to drill on Flora Banks. Is that so?
Yeah, it's interesting. It's been challenging. Like, if you actually, I did my research and I was able to find the actual certificate issued by the Canadian government allowing for the investigative work to take place. And part of the conditions on that certificate states that they will no longer be able to do their surveys if they are met with First Nations people who are asserting their right to live the land.
Yeah.
So technically, all of their work right now should be stopped because of the people out on the Leelu Island who are supporting Yohan, the chief of the Gitwokiot tribe, to protect the salmon estuary, which is Flora Banks, and it's the second biggest estuary in Canada. So our wild salmon on the northwest coast here is something that's very unique. It's in very high demand on the market, and I believe it's something that is worth protecting.
Despite Indigenous resistance and environmental concerns, the Northwest LNG project received federal approval in September 2016. In December, it was announced that Petronas is now reconsidering the location of the Pacific Northwest LNG project.
In March, an injunction and civil lawsuit was launched against water protectors who blocked construction of the Site C Dam for 62 days. Gunargi O'Sullivan recorded Yvonne Tupper, a member of Treaty 8, responding to the Supreme Court injunction at a press conference in Vancouver.
BC Hydro and the BC government need to start looking at culture competencies and start learning about Indigenous peoples and treaty rights. We're a named number treaty in the northeast of BC, which is unique than other Aboriginal titles of BC. We have a large area mass of Alberta, Saskatchewan, and Northwest Territories. And to learn about us through this process, we have 40 years of saying no from other political First Nations throughout the years. This is nothing new for us, but here to have a Supreme Court ruling, we're not here to not obey it. We're here to obey it. But we also, I knew that this is not the forum for it.
In December, BC Hydro announced that they would be expropriating Ken and Arlene Boone's family farm to construct the dam. Meanwhile, in November, the Supreme Court of BC rejected a petition by two First Nations to overturn provincial permits issued for the Site C Dam on the basis of inadequate consultation.
In July, demonstrations took place in Ottawa against the development of the Zibi condos and lack of consultation of Algonquin people on this unceded territory. Matt Cicero of CKCU reported from a sacred walk to stop the development on Chaudière Island.
Elders and activists spoke about the importance of protecting the falls. Jaina and Chartron is an Algonquin elder from Algonquin Park.
We should have a place where we can go, where it is sacred, where it has been sacred for thousands and thousands of years. We are here because of the next seven generations. Of your people and my people, to join hands in unity, to paddle both sides of the river in harmony. And remember, you can't paddle that canoe alone. It'll upset you. You might get wet. We need to unleash Shudia. We must release the falls.
In December, Kitigan ZB Chief Jean-Guy White Duck announced an Ontario Supreme Court challenge claiming title to much of the unceded lands in Ottawa, including Parliament Hill and the island where ZB condo developments are underway.
On the East Coast, water protectors occupied the Naucor Muskrat Falls construction site in October, voicing concerns over methylmercury contamination of the water. The project has been opposed by all three Indigenous governments in Labrador, and resistance has also included hunger strikes by three Inuit water protectors. The Supreme Court issued an injunction order that prohibited protesting at the Muskrat Falls gate. GroundWire's Carly Forbes recorded Lonzie Michelin speaking at a solidarity rally in Ottawa.
This dam has been a mistake from the very beginning. It is billions of dollars over budget, years behind schedule, and because of this, the provincial government thinks that they can cut corners and skip over important environmental mitigation.
Billy Gauthier, who was on hunger strike during the peak of the opposition to Muskrat Falls, also spoke at the rally.
And our people, all of our peoples, should be able to live on the lands in our traditional ways. And actually be able to keep our pride, because our pride is what's keeping us standing, and our pride is what's going to keep us standing in the future. Okay? And we will make Muskrat right. We will.
A deal was struck between the Labrador government and Indigenous leadership that led to some additional environmental protections in the dam construction. Community opposition to the Muskrat Falls construction continues with a rally taking place on New Year's Day at the gates of the construction site.
In 2016, approval was given for the Trans Mountain and Line 3 pipelines, while the Northern Gateway pipeline was rejected. The National Energy Board is set to restart hearings on the Energy East pipeline in 2017. Stay tuned to GroundWire for continued coverage of Indigenous resistance in the upcoming year.
Across Canada, migrants are jailed indefinitely without charge or trial forthcoming because Canada cannot deport them but will not release them. This means that many are locked up behind bars and separated from their families for years on end. Canada is a rogue nation going against legal frameworks in other countries which restrict the length of time migrants can be detained pending deportation. Migrants are unjustly imprisoned in maximum security prisons, and the United Nations has found that they do not have access to adequate judicial oversight. Adequate medical care is consistently denied. As a result, migrants are suffering, are separated from their families, and many are dying. During 2016, GroundWire has covered stories of migrant detentions and resistance. Here is a sample of what was covered.
Since Monday, July 11th, 60 brown and black men on immigration detention have been hunger striking from within the Central East Correctional Center in Lindsay, Ontario, and the Toronto East Detention Center in Scarborough, Ontario. The immigration detainees who have been organizing for their freedom since 2013 are demanding to meet with the Minister of Public Safety, Ralph Goodall. They want an end to indefinite immigration detention and believe Goodall can make that happen. Sharmeen Khan of the End Immigration Detention Network explains why detainees are fed up and how people end up in indefinite immigration detention.
This is the second hunger strike that many detainees have gone on. The first one was in 2013, and they started the hunger strike again yesterday for one simple demand. They want to have a meeting with the minister, Ralph Goodall, who's the Minister of Public Safety and who is the new Liberal minister in that portfolio, and they are insisting that they meet with him to talk about their conditions in detention and how it is indefinite. So when they can't be deported, they are held indefinitely in these detention centers, which are maximum security prisons.
We also spoke to an unnamed detainee who explained why he is striking along with his fellow inmates at the Central East Correctional Center.
I am taking part in the hunger strike because I was taught, if you don't stand for something, you'll fall for anything. With that being said, in life you have to make sacrifices to get your point across, to reach your demands, and to let them know how serious this matter is to us. And that will take drastic measures to fight for the better of our people and for a better cause, and hopefully they take heed and treat us like fairly like human beings.
Both Khan and the detainees stress that immigration detainees face deplorable prison conditions not seen in other ranges.
The conditions in Lindsay are quite bad. When there's a staffing issue, the prisons go into lockdown, and that means they, you know, locked in their cells sometimes for 18 to 21 hours a day. They also get different food, often worse food than the rest of the prison, and they don't have full access to health care, legal access, like legal visits and family visits. When they are released out of their cells, sometimes not even allowed to go outside. So some don't see fresh air for days. They only go into a larger cell, maybe to walk around a bit.
Are horrible, to be honest. The rooms are freezing cold. We don't get treated like a regular human. On holidays, we are supposed to get a hot tray all three meals, but on Canada Day, we got our regular cold tray in the morning and afternoons.
While Ralph Goodall has commented on the issue, Khan stresses that his viewpoint is not reassuring. At this point, the detainees are committed to continuing their strike until a meeting is set with the MP. This is Mina reporting from CFRU 93.3 FM.
On October 17th, 17 immigration detainees imprisoned in the Central East Correctional Center in Lindsay, Ontario, began refusing food. The immigration detainees are calling for an end to indefinite detention with a 90-day limit on detentions. This is the third hunger strike that immigration detainees have been on this year. In the last 6 months, three men have died in immigration detention in Canada. The most recent hunger strike ended on August 15th after promises were made by Federal Public Safety Minister Ralph Goodall on a new national immigration detention strategy. In a statement published by the End Immigration Detention Network, one of the detainees on hunger strike spoke on behalf of the 17, stating,
"We have been on hunger strike twice this year, most recently for 19 days, at the end of which we were promised real change. The minister went on the record and said that immigration detention is broken, but he did not specify long-term and indefinite detention, which impacts many of us, separating us from our families and making us sick. Consultations were promised and yet have not taken place directly with detainees. While we are the primary stakeholders, we want an end to indefinite detention. We don't want to be locked up in maximum security prisons. We want real access to effective legal remedies to contest our detention."
Many of the immigration detainees are imprisoned indefinitely without charges or trial. Limits on arbitrary detention are recommended by the United Nations and are law in the U.S. and the European Union.
We'll be right back after this music break.
We are the tribe that they cannot see. We live on an industrial reservation. We are the Halusa Nation. We have been called the Indians. We have been called Native American. We have been called hostile. We have been called pagan. We have been called militant. We have been called many names. We are the Halusa Nation. We are the human beings. The callers of names cannot see us, but we can see them. We are the Halusa Nation. Our DNA is of earth and sky. Our DNA is of past and future. We are the Halusa Nation. We are the evolution, the continuation. The Halusa Nation.
You just heard We Are the Halusa Nation by A Tribe Called Red, featuring John Trudell and Northern Voices, off their new album of the same name.
Black Lives Matter is an international activist movement that seeks justice from state-sanctioned violence against black people and fights ingrained anti-black racism in our societies. Canada's Black Lives Matter movements and the voices of black activists brought national attention to issues such as police carding and the targeting of black youth by Toronto police, police brutality, and murder of black men such as Andrew Locu and Jermaine Carby, and the systemic racism and violence towards black students on university campuses. Here's a review of some of the Black Lives Matter and other Black Solidarity movements covered by Groundwire this past year. The resistance against Vice Canada's representation of Somali communities in Toronto, and the Black Lives Matter stoppage of this year's Pride Parade.
On May 24th, Vice Canada released This is Dixon, a documentary that explores the post-Rob Ford anti-Somali sentiments in Dixon and throughout Canada. Dixon is a neighborhood in northwest Toronto that is home to a large Somali community, one of the biggest diasporas in Canada. Reactions to the Vice documentary by Progressive Somalis was enraged, as the documentary reproduces the very same vile and violent myths about Somali Canadians that the Toronto Police uses to legitimize its surveillance and violence within the community, such as the police raids in June 2013. Over the past month, in response to the documentary, Somali community members have led a campaign on social media under the hashtag That's Not Dixon to call upon Vice to remove the anti-black documentary from circulation and to adopt anti-racist accountability within their productions, focusing specifically on anti-blackness. Udbi is a Somali community organizer.
The documentary produces what is two decades of the City of Toronto and national Canadian institutions, often led by media reports vilifying the Somali community, and comes in the aftermath of similar mistreatments of the Jamaican community. The narrative Vice uses is not new. It reproduces the same historical abuses on the Somali community we have experienced by Canadian institutions, media, and the police. The documentary must be placed in a broader context of anti-black racism by the Canadian media.
Additionally, since the documentary itself was not even produced by Somalis, but rather outsiders from the United States, the community has been calling on Vice and indeed other media outlets to commission work from members of the Somali community to tell their own stories.
Back in July, Black Lives Matter protested the police presence in Pride Toronto. Mick Sweetman of CJRU now brings us coverage from a recent Pride Toronto town hall meeting.
On August 30th, hundreds of people attended a Pride Toronto town hall meeting where the discussion centered on Black Lives Matter Toronto's demand that police no longer be allowed to have floats or booths at the festival. At the meeting, the board members of Pride Toronto sat silently at the front of the room, listening to people address them at the open mic. The next day, I sat down with one of Pride's co-chairs to talk about what she heard from the community. We're joined here today with Alika Hall, who is one of the co-chairs of Pride Toronto. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
At the first town hall meeting, things got a little heated. Can I ask what your thoughts are, having watched that town hall meeting play out last week?
Yeah, I think that there was a lot of things yesterday that gave us pause and food for thought. I think it's just thinking through what processes and mechanisms we can put in place to ensure that people do feel like how they feel, what they think about Pride, what they want to see more of is actually reflected in there. Because I think that we don't have as many opportunities as we'd like to actually engage with community beyond the festival. And so creating additional spaces and as well as processes and ways for people to just contribute, I think will be really key for us moving forward.
One of the things that you said at the first town hall was that what the demand around police floats and booths was going to be treated as a complaint and dealt with in the dispute resolutions committee. Can you tell me why the board chose to use that process?
So the dispute resolution process was actually created for this exact scenario, when a group or an individual has a complaint or concern about the participation of another group in the Pride Parade. So I think as an organization, we would rely on a mechanism that was created by both community members as well as with the support of council and in consultation with the City of Toronto's policies to use a mechanism that already exists for our organization and has been actually used a number of times in the past year, as opposed to embarking on a process to do something differently or new.
One of the more specific demands around Pride Toronto was that Pride Toronto double the funding for Blockorama. Is that something that Pride Toronto is prepared to do?
Yes, that's something that Pride Toronto wants to do. And the organization, Pride Toronto, as I said today and yesterday at both town halls, is fully committed to working with Black queer organizations to do that.
One theme that kept reemerging at the meeting was that people were calling on Pride to return to its activist roots. Those roots are the confrontational protests of the bathhouse raids in 1981, where hundreds of people stood up against the Toronto Police's mass arrest of gay people.
Since April 1st, the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe have organized the Sacred Stone Camp to resist the Dakota Access Pipeline in North Dakota, USA. If built, the pipeline would have passed under the Missouri River twice and run over the Sioux tribe's sacred sites and burial ground. The Department of the Army did not approve an easement that would allow the proposed Dakota Access Pipeline to cross under Standing Rock Sioux Tribe land, forcing the pipeline to find alternative routes and may see the end of the project altogether. The success against the Dakota Access Pipeline serves as an important inspiration for other struggles that continue. The Obama and Trudeau administrations have approved several other pipeline projects slated to run across Indigenous territories from Canada to the U.S. and Mexico. The struggle to protect sacred lands from climate change, toxic pollution, and fossil fuel industry continues to rage around the world. In the year ahead, the energy and support for the struggle against the Dakota Access Pipeline should be extended and continues to inspire other Indigenous communities in their local battles, such as the Copper One Rivière Dorée Mine in Quebec, Line 3 Pipeline in Alberta, Kinder Morgan Trans Mountain Pipeline, and others. Here are some highlights of Groundwire's coverage of solidarity with Standing Rock. This segment was produced by Glenn S., from CIVL Radio in Abbotsford, and audio files from Co-op Radio Vancouver and CKUW in Winnipeg.
Here's Gunari and Billy Pierre from Co-op Radio in Vancouver talking to Myron Dewey, who's been taking videos at Standing Rock.
Well, you know, just trying to cover through Indigenous eyes the media and following the protocols as well, when and when not to film, you know, and shutting up the camera and getting the approval. And so I'm also doing a youth media class down here with our youth storytellers and journalists.
My goodness. So this,
the
stand that people have been taking at in North Dakota has actually influenced the youth to pick up the camera and become the media?
Well, I'm coming in from Paiute Shoshone country, and I had some of our relatives down there in Paiute country buy an iPad. And I got my camera, and whatever I got, I can share with them. And so we used mobile phones the first day, and now we're just trying to recruit some more youth to go in and do some digital story challenge from the inside out.
That's so great. Wow. There must be people from, like, all nations over there, eh?
You know, this is one of the strongest healing circles I've ever been to. You know, you have black, white, Chicano, all nations, and people coming in and in solidarity, and for non-natives to come in and in solidarity, that's part of the healing process.
Wow, that's so amazing. So everyone's united in the struggle for life to protect, I do believe, the Missouri River?
Yes, we can see it right here where I'm up on a hill we call Facebook Hill. It's the only spot where we can get internet and make calls. And you can see the water from here. Teepees are all lined up along it. People are camping and cooking, and right now, there's getting ready to be a show with some Native artists coming on, and it's awesome.
Gunari would also hear from Jesus, a Saskatoon-based musician who also took part in the events of Standing Rock.
And I see that there's a lot of action going on. To me, it seems like there's a lot of police presence, and can you tell me more about that from your perspective?
From what I hear, when we came in yesterday, it was a bit tense because a couple of brothers were actually arrested yesterday. At an incident at one of the sites. So basically the camp is not on site. So for a lot of people online who are sharing like information, just know that the camp has nothing to do with the actual pipeline construction site. The camp is where everybody's just kind of gathering and praying and, basically taking care of each other and coming up with ways to get through this. You know, there's all types of things that need to be done, you know, just from the kitchen to the firewood to protecting the women in the sweats. There's also sweats going on out here from different tribes. There's marches. We went down by the burial grounds today, and it's crazy. Like, the feeling out here is unreal.
Uh-huh. Exactly. That's what I noticed. I've been watching a lot of how the Native youth there have pulled together to share this news. They've been getting funding for equipment like cameras, microphones, you name it, and now a trailer of all things, right? It's just amazing how it's motivated the people and inspired them to take this a step further.
Yeah, no doubt. today I've met people from all over North America, you know, all over North America, from Montreal, French-speaking natives to Paiute natives, to Haida. Some of the Haida sisters just left this morning back to Haida Gwaii. So, I mean, you know, it's really crazy to come into a place that is completely foreign, like, to me, like, as far as, like, the location and the community and the people. It's like, I don't know the place, like, and I've never been here before, but it feels like home.
That was Myron Dewey and Dries, both from Standing Rock, talking to Gennari from Co-op Radio in Vancouver. CKUW Radio in Winnipeg would also examine the events unfolding in North Dakota.
And we're lucky enough to be joined in the studio by Sadie Phoenix-Lavoy. Tell us about your trip that you took last week down to the Dakotas. What was it like going there?
The Standing Rock Sioux Nation's Cannonball Reservation, where the river sustains so many communities. It was the main drinking source, but there was going to be a pipeline that was going to be constructed to go right through it. So obviously posed a huge risk, high risk. And so the community, you know, banded together and was like, no, we have to resist this. And there was the Indigenous Environmental Network that went on, had a video, and they were saying that, you know, this is a very peaceful protest. It's done in ceremony where there's women and children and elders and, you know, pipe carriers and Eagle Staff carriers and all these drummers, singers, and they're all here, you know, defending the land. And we were calling on people for solidarity and support. They were saying that the Nakota, Dakota and Lakota, like the three nations, or there's like the second or seven fire councils, so like the five, seven nations representing that area. They said it was the first time that they ever banded together in alliance in over 100 years.
Lavoy wasn't the only person CKUW talked to about the Sacred Stone Camp. Here's Josini, also known as Healing Earth Woman, discussing the Standing Rock Sioux's resistance of the Dakota Access Pipeline.
Okay. So you were in Standing Rock. You were at the Standing Rock camp in recent weeks. Could you tell us a little bit about that visit? I mean, how you came to be down there, and a little bit about what you saw and experienced there.
It's a good thing, but it's also a sad thing, because it's this big black snake that are bringing all the people together to fight against it. But it's also like, it's amazing how many of our people are all different tribes that are there.
The resistance that you talk about from the state and state authorities, I mean, could you talk a bit more, maybe the tactics they're using, underhanded or otherwise?
Well, the first thing that really, when I was down there, the first thing that really I was uncomfortable was when they started to talk about the National Guard coming in. And it's another form of psychological to put on the people, so that, you know, like, the actions were already starting to happen, and, you know, they already had these dogs that attacked the people, and you know, it just that psychological warfare that the industry is putting on the people, and there are people who are going to stand up against it no matter what.
Yeah.
They're not going to back down.
That's it for the 2016 Year in Review episode of Groundwire.
Music this week was by A Tribe Called Red.
Thanks to all contributors from across the country for a great 2016 season. We also thank Glenn S., Carly Forbes, and Ome Salma Rahamtala for this review episode.
Tune in to hear Groundwire in 2017 on your local community radio station, or download at groundwirenews.ca.